latest people, trends, and news on sustainable living in and around our corner of the country. Down to Earth with Mrs. Green. Spotlight on the Southwest. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to Down to Earth with Mrs. Green. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and we're going to put a very meaningful and intentional spotlight on the Southwest, and indeed on every living being who listens to this show. And I thank you for listening and for being a part of Mrs. Green's world. And as I always do at the top of the show, I'd like to thank the sponsor for this show and a great Mrs. Green's World partner, a great partner for Tucson and Pima County, Tucson Medical Center. For 70 years, members of our community have counted on TMC to be here for us when we are at our most vulnerable. They have been entrusted with this legacy, and they continue the tradition of improving the health and well-being of the people of Southern Arizona in almost every way possible that I can think of when it comes to taking care of us and of our community. So today's show is all about taking care of people when they truly are at their most vulnerable. Hospice care, a hard conversation. Joining me in studio are Kim Foer, Director of Hospice Care, and Dr. Larry Lincoln, So you're the Director of Hospice Care, and you are the Medical Director, right?
Correct. That's correct.
Yes, okay. They're a little flub, but it's okay. We're all human beings. And I changed it on one and not on the other. So Dr. Larry Lincoln is the Medical Director of Hospice Care and author of the book, Reclaiming Vanished Voices, Stories on the Road to Compassion. So thank you so much, both of you, for being here and for what you do. And you've had three tearful sessions with me already in just the previous show. But that makes, to me, the show more meaningful because it's something so relatable for me and how hospice care helped me and my family with the death of both my parents. It was not possible without hospice care to get us through. I can't emphasize that enough. So why don't we start with the overall approach with hospice at TMC to just get our listeners familiar with that?
Well, there's a lot of things that we provide. Hospice typically has a stigma in, you know, the community and around the country where...
Wow, not for me.
Well, you know, you associate hospice immediately with death and dying.
Yes, yes.
And our culture focuses so much on longevity and youth. But one of the things that we like to say is it's not about death and dying. It's about the quality of life that you have left and what you can do with it. And we also support the families. We have social workers, we have chaplains, we have counselors, we have therapies, we have everything, and we come at it as a team approach of how is this patient going to handle the rest of their time with us? And that's pretty much what hospice does.
And so yesterday I had Julia and Mary Atkinson talking about a whole other subject, but it's very intentional at TMC. Pretty much everything. I've interviewed a lot of guests, and I'm a client and all of those things. But do you have a mission that you can articulate?
Our mission is providing excellence in healthcare with compassion. It's just simple, and that's what we do. That's what we do. We try to give our patients, and we strive to give everything that we do the most excellent healthcare that we can give them, and also with compassion.
So tell me more about what it is and what it does. You know what I mean? So what is hospice care? It's a big, like you said, there's a lot of misunderstanding. But at TMC, what is it? I want to go into like when does it start and all of those questions. But in general, what is hospice care?
It's helping people pass on and pass into their next phase of life that we're all going to face in the way that they want to. It's about compassion. It's about no anxiety. It's about being pain-free. It's offering all of those things, helping them stay at home instead of being in the hospital where they're around their friends and families and loved ones. And go ahead.
Okay, but I want to know, I never know if I'm saying this right, but is it palliative care?
Not always.
What is that word? That's a different, right?
Right. It's not always. So hospice... you have to have a diagnosis that gives you 6 months or less.
Okay.
Palliative care, you could be on that type of service for up to 2 years, for example. You may get a diagnosis, but you may not be facing death for the next 2 to 5 years. So then you have the palliative care. With hospice care, you may be faced with a diagnosis where you may only have 6 months. That's the big difference.
Okay, so there's really a difference.
Yeah, so hospice is in some ways a subset of palliative care, mm-hmm. in that there's a time frame with hospice, whereas with palliative care, they're both holistic care, helping people live the life they want to live and match medical care with their goals. So palliative care could allow, for instance, people to have, who have chronic illness, have chemotherapy or even an open heart surgery, if that matched their goals. In hospice, we limit therapeutic interventions because at that point, people have made the decision that they want comfort over life-prolonging interventions.
You know, we got to talk a little bit before we went on air about your life and your journey, and I just would like to interject here or have you share with us. You were in an entirely different area of medicine, and you were back east for the beginning of your career, and then you came west with the rest of us about the same time, and we're glad you did. But what was your specialty before, and then how did it lead you to hospice?
I trained back east in internal medicine and infectious disease, and I came out here to do infectious disease. And in fact, that's what I did full time. Got really very busy with that. In 1969, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross had just written her book on death and dying.
Talk about an icon in this world forever.
And I was a medical student at the time, and there was a little blurb that this woman was going to come and talk about death and dying, and I thought I might see a dying patient one day. So I went to her seminar, and she was a great storyteller and told lots and lots of stories about the patients she had met. I rushed out her butt and bought her book, but I didn't have time to read it.
Because you were in medical school.
Exactly.
Right. 14, no time for that.
14 years later, I'm rounding on the oncology ward at TMC getting at 4 o'clock in the morning because that's how I started my day. It was so busy. Wondering how I was going to keep up this pace for the next 30 years. And there I saw she was going to give another talk. And I bought tickets for a couple who'd lost a child and my wife who didn't hear her back in 69. And during her talk, when she was talking about accepting one's own death, I thought, that wouldn't be a bad way out of this. I mean, and so we were out in the parking lot and I stopped my wife and friends and said, I've got to go back in there. And went back in there, pushed my way through a crowd that was surrounding her while she was signing books, which is not my style, really.
Right.
And whispered in her ear, and she stood up and said, she's Swiss. You come to my next workshop. And so I I went home and I filled out the application and got in the car and drove to a mailbox because I knew that if I didn't mail it at 11 o'clock that night, I wouldn't do it. And so I went to her workshop and she had started workshops for the dying, and it was clear that the people bringing the dying often needed the workshops more than the dying. And her workshops, which people really don't know much about, were really intense grief and spiritual retreats.
Right.
And it was there that I got in touch with a voice that I had banished, and that's the reason I have the title for the book, 32 years before. That's another whole long story.
But we're going to get you back. I've already made that declaration because I want to hear more of those stories too. I really do.
So I went to the workshop and then decided I loved that work. I trained with Elizabeth and then she asked me to lead her workshops. And knowing that I was leading those workshops with the death and dying maven, TMC asked me to become medical director when they opened the hospice in 1991. So that's why I'm doing it.
That's your journey.
Yeah.
So the question that I have many questions, but you know, you said 6 months, like, okay, terminally ill for 6 months. But at what point is it decided that it's time for hospice care? Is it with families? Can they say, no, I'm be in denial? How hard a process is that, and does it give a relief? This is, of course, coming into four questions now. But you know what I'm asking. It's like, at what point is it decided? And then families obviously have to be participating in the decision. And how does that all work at TMC?
I think sometimes it depends a lot on the patient and the families. We've gotten some referrals where the families are ready. They're, you know, we're going to put you on hospice care. This is the process, and they're ready for it. Then we have other families that they have a lot of guilt putting a loved one in hospice care until we talk to them. And we say, you know, it doesn't mean we're not going to treat them. We're going to offer them comfort. We're going to do this. And we have these grief counselors, and we have social workers, and we can help with placement if that's what it is. You can stay in your home. If you don't want to stay in your home, there's an option to come inpatient to Pepe's house. So there's all these different multifaceted things that we talk to with the families about. And sometimes the nurses do it. Sometimes Dr. Lincoln does it. It's sometimes the social workers are helping, the spiritual counselors. We have all of the support for the families to answer all of their questions. And sometimes it's just a matter of that letting them talk through it to feel comfortable, and then the choice is made.
So is the decision to be in a person's home or to be at Pepe's house at TMC based on any medical conditions, or is it strictly the family wants, or the patient who's dying wants to be, you know, to die at home, which was my dad. That's all he wanted was to die at home. And he was in hospice in the hospital, and the closer it got, he said, please just take me home. Mm-hmm. And that's what he wanted. He was slowly fading because of his heart. It wasn't anything like the cancer was going to get him or whatever, but mm-hmm. whose decision is that?
Sometimes it's the family. So if the patient can be stable at home, home is a preference. And 90% of our patients, I would say, are from the home.
Wow.
But if it gets to the point where the family's interventions aren't keeping them comfortable, we're going to bring them into Pepe's house. Or if they're anxious, or if they're having other type of symptoms that the families are having a hard time dealing with at home, we'll bring them into Pepe's house. Sometimes the families need a break. Caregiver role strain is huge.
It's really huge.
Some people don't realize how huge it is until they're in that role. And so if the families need a break, we're going to take them into Pepe's house to let those families heal.
That's why it's like hospice respite.
It is respite.
Seriously, which mm-hmm. I so understand. I mean, yeah. it's so emotionally exhausting, but physically exhausting as well.
There are, Medicare has created criteria for admission to hospice. And so my job as medical director is to make sure that the patients meet those criteria.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that somebody...
That's huge to add that, though. That's really important.
So we have calls from people who have a family member, let's say with dementia, but the patient is still up and around talking, and they could really use the extra help, but we can't admit them until we think they're within a 6-month time frame. Now, we're wrong a lot. We have quite a few people that outlive the 6 months, and so long as they continue to decline, we can keep them on our program as long as we document that they're in decline.
And that, but, you know, of course, to me, it makes so much sense, especially if they're in home hospice, mm-hmm. to be there, to not have the expense of a hospital, but for the patient and the family to know services are going to be provided in the home.
Right.
That's what, assuages your fears.
Yeah. And they're free, which is great. Nobody gets a bill.
Right.
Because the patient, at least the patients in the Medicare age, they switch to a Medicare hospice plan, and Medicare pays the hospices so much a day, and we provide all the staffing and medical equipment and medications related to diagnosis for free.
I had no idea, and that's huge for our listeners to hear that, too.
Some of the families are very surprised when we say we'll take care of all of that.
I'm surprised.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I'm surprised.
And we also offer a bereavement program for 13 months after a patient passes away to help with those families adjust to the grief and the bereavement.
So I want to talk about probably the hardest one for me, mm-hmm. the thing that every parent fears, children's hospice. Mm-hmm. I mean, children die. I'm part of Angel Charity, and I, you know, have been on boards, and that's the hardest. So tell me about children's hospice at TMC, and how does it differ, and, you know, what that's just like hard to even ask the question.
It is. It's difficult. We're the only hospice that does peds. I got into hospice because of peds. I was a home care nurse on the East and was taking care of a lot of kids. I had a huge kiddo caseload. And some of these kids were terminal, and they didn't have the option of putting them in hospice. And watching what these poor families went through, it was, I just wanted to do more. I wish we could do more. I wish we could do more. And that's how I ended up getting into hospice, was because of that. It's difficult. We provide the same services to the families. We know everything that hospice does with the social work and the bereavement and the counseling. It's a whole different ball game when it comes to the children. The families need the utmost support, total support. And we're there for them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit more in detail. So there's social work services, because mm-hmm. I really want people to understand all of the benefits of being in hospice. So there's social work services, their medical care is taken care of, whether they're in home or in the hospital, mm-hmm. right? What about things like when you talk about what kind of support do you give to the family? Is the social work mostly for the family members?
It can be. We have, for the families, we do have the social workers. We also have the nursing visits. We have nursing assistant visits that help with the bathing and getting them up and getting them dressed, feeding if they need it. We have a spiritual counselors that can help with the families and or the patients. And then we have ancillary therapies, which includes music, meditation, pet therapy.
Awesome.
It's a whole myriad of things that we give. And we offer it to every patient, not just, we don't cherry pick. Every single patient has access to all of these therapies. In Pepe's house, we've had Clydesdales come in. We open up the patio, and they come into the patient's room.
You are kidding.
No, we do. No.
And they are big. They don't come into the room. They are big horses.
They don't come into the room.
They don't come into the room. The
head goes into the room.
Oh, my God, that's unbelievable. Just the thrill of that. And, I mean, who doesn't know the healing, you know, magic of pets, too?
Right.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
We just... It's so important.
And we also have a veterans program, too. And we do veteran ceremonies.
I want to ask you about that, because that was one of the things on the note I got. We honor veterans programs. So what is that all about?
So we have a group of volunteers. That's another service we offer, is volunteers. And a lot of them, some of them are veterans. And so the second we hear that there's a veteran coming into Pepe's house, for example, we hang a flag in there. Then we do a veterans honoring, where the vets come in and they talk to the patient or the family about their service. They thank them for the service. We provide them with a plaque. We do this big honoring for them and for their families to thank them. You know, we don't have very many World War II vets left, but when we have them, we make sure. And there's a whole bunch of stories that go along with that, but it might make you cry.
But it's okay. I'll cry silently. But those are great stories. I mean, my Rotary was very much involved with the flying with vets from mm-hmm. Tucson that got to go to the Washington, D.C., and companions for them. And you're right. There are not that many left.
Right. One of the ceremonies they did, and Lewis, and he's one of our veteran volunteers, and the patient was an alert, and he was talking with the families, and at the end of the ceremony, they gave a salute. Well, he looked over, and there's the patient laying in bed saluting.
Oh, that would make me cry.
Yeah. So it really is. It's a huge, huge impact on these patients and their families. It's wonderful. And if any of the families also have a vet, they honor them as well within that ceremony.
So... Larry, what do you get to, like, the medical director, big decision role? I mean, wow, talk about heavy duty. Do you get to be involved in interacting with the patients?
Every day.
Every day?
So I make rounds on our inpatient unit, and so I take care of the patients there. And they're fairly high acuity patients. They come from ICUs, from TMC plus other hospitals. We get referrals from all the hospitals in town. So we take care of very sick people. So I have the privilege of doing that. And some of them arrive unconscious. And I ask the families to bring photos because we, you know, we all kind of look the same at some point as we get close to the end.
Right,
especially us older people. And
I look in the mirror and I'm like, who is that?
Exactly.
Is that your neck?
And so we ask them to bring photos so we can hear about who these people are. And so a lot of times it's educating the families and supporting the families. Sometimes, however, the patients come in and they're still awake and they want to talk and they want to share their stories and share their fears, because a lot of them are very, very scared about. Some are afraid of death and what happens after death, and almost all of them are afraid of the journey. You know, how much pain am I going to be in?
Right.
You know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So do you, when it's, you know, I mean, the emotions, of course, are going a little wild for me, but with patients, do they sometimes have a lot of anxiety because they know their family is like totally freaked out and sad? And does that become a concern, like with kids? And how does that all come down?
Right, sure. Yeah, oftentimes the person who's dying is more worried about the people they're leaving behind, the people, and oftentimes family members love their loved ones differently. So one family member may be saying, you know, I just hope it's over soon, because she's in a lot of pain.
Right,
right. And another family member loves that person and says, why is she in hospice? Why can't we do more?
Right.
And they both love their families. So it's our job to show them that love is there and it's expressed differently, because there can be some disagreements in family. So it's really trying to create a container large enough for every member of the family, including the person who's in hospice, so that when it's time, when that person dies, that there's some closure for everyone. And that's part of our job, to do that. Our social workers are involved in that. Our nurses, our chaplains, we're all involved in doing that. One of the biggest things on the unit is that our patients are bathed every day with clean sheets every day. And you'd think that would be standard, but that's not standard anymore in today's hospitals. So one of the biggest things we do is when patients arrive, they arrive and they're swarmed by our staff.
Right.
And they get this spa treatment.
The big, warm welcome.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
And so the families are sitting in the waiting room, and then they come in and they see their family member shaved and clean, and, you know, they
that's so important.
Sometimes getting a haircut.
I get it. I get it. I really do. And you probably don't know this, and it's really fine. I take no offense. But we had the head person from the laundry operation at TMC on the show, and it was delightful. It was so delightful that Julia listened to it, and she told people to listen to it, because it's all about the culture of TMC and mm-hmm. how they care, and it's in-house. They don't send it out. And I mean, it's another one where I said, I'm glad I don't have that job. The towels, the sheets, the pillowcases, and it's controlling disease. I mean, it's a thing.
Mm-hmm. We had a patient who was a very large woman, young, who was dying of cancer. She had one wish, to be able to take a bath, but one bath before she died.
Oh my gosh.
Now we have these showers that people can go in.
Right,
you know,
right.
But
a bathtub?
Bathtubs, and we had just moved into our new building.
Mm-hmm.
So our social worker put the word out, called the people that handle the site at Tucson Medical Center, said, we have a problem. We need to get a bath. So in our old hospice building, before we moved, downstairs, there was a big whirlpool bath. The people that take care of the facilities said, we'll take care of this. They scrubbed it. They cleaned it, made sure it worked fine. And we got a van, and they helped her lift into the tub. They even pick flowers for her. The facilities people pick flowers
for
her.
You've got to be kidding me.
And so they made this room absolutely beautiful, and she was, you know, she had an hour-long bath before she died. And that came from the
facilities managers.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That should be in the TMC annual report.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not kidding, because I actually have a copy of that and got great stories from it, because it's about people, right, and it's about sharing their stories. And I look and I see my friend Sandy, and I'm like, I didn't even know she almost died. She had a heart attack. She's a Rotarian with me, Sandy Goodsight. And I was like, I called her up. I said, Sandy, I had no idea. TMC really, not only made her day, made her life. She's still now very active 10 years later in Rotary and all of this stuff. So it's unbelievable. Of course, I lost my train of thought. Do you have a program, Larry? Are you trying to make me cry?
She hasn't cried yet.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, it's coming.
It's close.
But it's like, that's like extraordinary. And I'm so glad you shared that story, because I think it is exemplary of what TMC does.
Correct.
To go to that extra, that's like extra 10 miles. Oh, wow. Is there a program called Dream Makers?
It's a new program that we're getting ready to start. And what that is Larry just kind of explained it with that story, whereas if a patient has a wish towards their end of life.
Got it.
We had a donor and we had a grant, and we're going to try to fulfill those wishes for those patients, whatever it may be. We're not sure yet. It's a very new program, but working with our social workers and the TMC's aging department, we have a network of volunteers, whereas if a patient says, I want a meal from Caruso's, for example, we're going to make it happen for that family,
awesome,
those patients.
Like, how awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they want to see one of the big U of A basketball players, like,
right,
for kids and all that, it's a delightful thing to think about. And I have a couple more questions, but I want to make sure, if people have questions about this, because everybody out there, the 100% absolute is, all of us will be impacted by this, mm-hmm, at some point in our life. If you, mm-hmm, haven't been, you will be. Don't be in denial. To know better is to do better. So is it best to go to the TMC website and find hospice, and that's how to connect with you? Because people aren't writing down phone numbers when I'm talking. I like to really tell them, TMC's website is very easy to navigate.
Yeah, it is. And there's a link right there for hospice right off their website.
Yeah. So one of my last questions, if we have time, and I hope we do, is, and I don't mean this to be pithy at all, how do you do it? Yeah. How do each of you do it day after day after day, face death and dying?
You know, I get asked that question a lot when I tell somebody.
That's
what
why I said I don't want it to be like,
yeah,
cliche.
No,
it matters.
Okay. When I get asked that question, they're like, oh my gosh, how do you deal with that? And I'm like, listen, I've been a nurse for a long time. I actually have a trauma background. The deaths, those sudden deaths that you see as a nurse working in the facility and in the acute care setting or the ICUs are so much more traumatic than they are for those that,
right,
are, that they know it's coming. It's such a good way to make a difference, whereas in the hospital, sometimes you don't have time.
I get it. I really get it. And it's just, what do you do? Like, I...
And they're not all my mother. You know,
that's true.
When my mother died in hospice, I was a different person. And I was the medical director for over 15 years, and I was a different person. So, I mean, people ask me that all the time. I couldn't do it if they were all my mother.
Mm-hmm.
People ask me about what I do, because I cover really tough topics. I cover a lot of death and dying. I cover, you know, like I was telling you, child. Everything has to do with, to me, a sustainable and socially just planet. And some days it kicks my butt.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
I'm emotionally drained after I hear what's going on in the world and have to, like, take a break, and I have to, like, do something fun or go out and ride my bike or read.
Right.
Because it's hard to face it.
Right. And some of the nurses they're really making a difference. A lot of them are really and truly making a difference in these people's lives. And that's the satisfaction that they take away from it.
Right. We help. We help a lot.
You help a lot.
But
a real lot.
Every week, we also have a closure. We name all the patients who've died. And if we have something we want to say, we honor them every week. And that's part of the way of our having closure so we can continue.
And TMC has a lot of support services for their staff gyms and groups and on and on and on. So it's, to me, really taking care of the caregivers is a part of that, too. Even those, like, all the gardens. I love that women's garden. It was like, it's beautiful. You can go out and sit out there, and really it's a meditative place to go. So I want to forward promote to upcoming shows for the month of May. We are dedicating our shows to women from around the world fighting global warming. They are underrepresented, shocking, as the top scientists in the world. So Diana Liverman is our next guest. She is actually from the University of Arizona. She wrote an incredible paper, Climate for Women's Voices in Climate Science, The Good, the Bad, and the Truth. So she did a research paper on how women's voices, even scientists in climate change, are underreported. So that's, of course, of interest to me. And then our Down to Earth show is Ernie Garcia and Hector Sylvan from Tucson Urban League. And another thing, a winning partnership between the Urban League and Tucson Electric Partners. So I'm really thrilled with that. And with that, I'm just going to say thank you to both of you. And I really want you to come back and talk about your book. I really do, because I think this is a service that we provide to the planet of getting people to really get their head around it. And I love stories.
I'd love to.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
It was wonderful.